You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to episode 37 of the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I am your host, Professor Carlton Shieldchief Grover, and I am so excited to have you join me as we explore the rich and fascinating histories of North America's Great Plains. I'm having fun going through some myths. So after my last, I rarely get emails. I have to say that. There's a couple folks that will send me stuff pretty frequently, and I appreciate it. But definitely when I touch myths and legends, that's when I start getting emails. And so most of them positive, others not so positive, which is fine. I only have a PhD in this field and understand the archaeological record and what verifiable evidence means. But who can say? Who can say? Anywho, I was really stoked, I could say, of one email I got. I don't have their name. Omega Theorem. I don't believe that's their actual name. They emailed me a couple things. One myth that comes from the Southeast, another that comes from Mandan Hidatsa Rekra in the Great Plains, and another that comes with the Paiute. And some of the context that they're talking about with some of these myths involve other, like your early European folks that got to the Americas and set up shop. And so they're kind of fun to talk about. Sorry, I'm having a mint. Rediscovering Altoids recently. Anywho, whatever happened to the citrus Altoids? Do you guys remember those? They're like all the craze early 2000s. Anywho, so some of these that we're going to talk about, I've never really been presented with. Like, I do my best to stay away from pseudoarch. If many of you recall, early on in Life in Ruins, when me, David, and Connor interviewed Bernie Taylor to talk about cave art, kind of soured me on engaging with pseudoarchaeology, pseudoscience. And then especially as we become like a professional reaching middle age, like there's only so much time and energy I want to put into these things. Like in my 20s, when we first started doing this, I was like 26, 27 when the podcast Life in Ruins first took off. Different times, a little bit more vibrant, could talk about things, happy to get involved in other things. But now I'm just like, man, I just got to grade papers. So times have definitely changed. Anywho, enough about me yapping. So we're going to talk about three things, at least to begin with, because this is going to be probably a little rambly episode, but I'm enjoying it. One, we're going to look into the Dahar people that were allegedly in Georgia, which is in Southeast United States, not the country, in Central Asia. Dive a little bit into some Mandan Nation alleged French documentation of MHA talking about people with red hair, fair skin, red and green eyes, like a tribe of them that live in the region. Who the hell knows? And then moving a little bit further west, talking about the Paiutes with another whole thing of red hair giants. And so like leading up to this episode, I hadn't heard these before. And so diving into them, like just looking like, okay, like doing a quick Google search before even pulling up like JSTOR or Google Scholar, like what is out there, because that usually directs. Anytime I see an article by ancientorigins.net, I immediately know like whatever content I'm about to go into is totally fringe bullshit, which is always fun. But the Dahar people, there's like YouTube videos or something of like more recently people are diving into this. And I saw something adjacent to it on Facebook a couple weeks ago being shared by a tipo, which was also bizarre. Like, why is a tipo sharing like white people being in West Virginia before Columbus? That was a little bonkers. So who are the Dahar? So allegedly, you know, if you look this up, different things will say different, just nonsense. So if we go to, I'm going to go to Indian Country Today. They have an article on this, which I thought was also absolutely bonkers that Indian Country decided to take this on back in 2014. The legend of the Dahar comes from an account that came about in 1521 by a Spaniard named Peter Martyr, who allegedly took reports from Columbus and other explorers, you know, other Spanish colonists who were scouting the Southeast, particularly the coast of South Carolina, Georgia. Allegedly, a Chicora native and a Spanish explorer reported to Martyr that they had come across a group of people that called themselves the Duhair, and that they were different than other natives in the area, that they had light white skin and brown hair that hung to their heels, and that they herded deer in a way that Europeans herded cattle. And they would milk the deer and make cheese. And so, a lot to unpack there. And then did you hear by the time other folks, Europeans, actually settled into the area, like early 1600s, so like 80 years later, they had just been subsumed into the Creek Nation? That's like pretty quick, right? That's only one or two, even three generations away after like just being subsumed. Like Creeks would have been fair skin back then. Anyway, so like this gets wrapped up with like an Irish tint to it, because in Gaelic lore, there is, you know, celebrations of reindeer milking, but that doesn't really become a thing until like the 1300s. And so there's this natural placation of like, oh, they're milking deer, they're fair skinned, they're probably Gaelic in some way, shape, or form. One that's, as an isolated population, going to be hard to do, right? And there's no archaeological evidence for like deer corrals or like domestication outside of turkeys in the Southeast. As far as I'm aware, like there's no oral traditions from Cherokee, Choctaws, Chickasaws, and groups from the Southeast that even describe whatever's going on here. And there's just no archaeological signature, right? And so like, if you had a group to show up from England, and this is perfect because we were just talking about Kansas City Hopewell, my Great Plains archaeology class, how it shows up like somewhat contemporaneously, a little bit later than regular Hopewell. And we had a huge discussion about, okay, is Kansas City Hopewell representative of migration or cultural diffusion? And even though they still have mounds, Kansas City has mounds like they do in Hopewell mounds proper. And I imagine if Dr. Murphy is listening to this, who knows Hopewell more than I do, can correct me, but generally KCH or Kansas City Hopewell mounds are constructed differently. The pottery looks similar, but the designs have a local woodland flair to them and they're locally made. And so if we were to have like this Gaelic population that just shows up in the Southeast, it's going to have a completely different material culture associated with it. Even originally, they're going to come in with different styles. There's going to be much more readily available cultural packages that would be akin to wherever these people showed up from. And they're not just going to, you would see a sudden shift in the archaeological record, both the settlement pattern, like people coming from Ireland who settle in a certain way and create houses in a certain way, even in, you know, the 11 to 1400s or whenever the hell it was, they're going to come there with and start when their first settlements are going to be built like European Scottish settlements or Irish settlements. They're not going to look like Southeast longhouses. That's just not going to happen. We see that anytime there's a migrant population, initially, their way to build a house is how they build it when they first arrive to a new place, like Scott County Pueblo. There's a Pueblo out in Kansas, Picarias Pueblo. It's belongs to them. Like when they fled the Spanish to get to Kansas, like they didn't know you had to build an earth lodge. Like all they knew how to do is like to them, a house was a Pueblo, and they did their damnedest to build a Pueblo out in the middle of Kansas, right? And so like archaeologically, it's not just, this is a ridiculous story. What is the ethnographic evidence for indigenous folks living in the area for a tribe of white people who are milking deer? Because that'd be pretty prevalent. Like that's an odd thing to do. Like we all have stories of the neighborhood weird kid or kid with the, you know, the quote unquote weird kid in school that they just did something that always sticks with us. And you think this group of white folks living out in South Carolina before Columbus gets there, milking deer, that's just strange. And you think that'd be more pervasive in at least in the oral traditions, right? And so there's different ways that we can look at how to verify this evidence. It doesn't look like, and I know this is a Great Plains podcast, we're talking about Southeast, but you know, we try to throw Kansas City Hopewell Flare in there. There's little evidence. And what does the material culture look like in the region for this? Like, it's a fantastical story. Why was this report written? Who can say? Maybe this like this native convert and the Spanish explorer trying to like lure the Spanish to settle in South Carolina to find these people. Like, there could have been like a tent to this to try to get folks to get there. Who can say? But for the 1500s to have this like distinct population of like clearly non-locals, and within 100 years, who's like, when's Croatan established? Let me check. But this is important. Croatan or Roanoke colony. Yeah, like 1585. It's not Georgia. It's just further up the coast. But like, and then Jamestown established 1607. I don't know. That's a pretty quick amount of time to get subsumed into the Muscogee Cree, and then have any genetic evidence left, right? Like, there's still, you know, speaking as a third generation, or you know, two generations away. Like, I'm, you know, my grandfather was fully American Indian, you know, by genetics, if you want to go that way, right? I still have some tinge at times. Like, I still have some traits and features that are reminiscent of being Pawnee. And that was like, it's been over 100 years. So, or I don't know. That's a hard sell for me. I'm going to get back from the break. We're going to talk more about MHA. And I bet Chris and Rachel are fucking thrilled that I'm sitting here chewing on mints while recording a podcast. All right. I'll see you guys after this break. And I'll be done with mints. I'm going to have to give you a call back because I just wanted to say hi, but I'm recording a podcast. But now that I have you on, there's actually, I have a question relevant to you, because we're talking about, by we, I'm talking about me and my microphone and the cat that's in the cat tower. Have you ever heard of the Duhair tribe, the Dahar tribe, a tribe in the Georgia or the Carolinas of fair-skinned, complected people who domesticated deer and made deer cheese?
No, I have not. Cherokees have a story, like ancestrally, about the blue-eyed ones.
Oh God, don't! I just talked about that last episode. How there's no evidence for this, and now you're going to tell me that the Cherokees have a story about blue-eyed people. Continue.
But as far as I know, there's nothing about them having fair skin. They're just like freaky-looking blue-eyed, brown-skinned natives. As far as I'm aware.
Did they milk deer?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Sounds good.
I've never heard that. Milking deer, that's nuts.
Well, I Googled this nonsense, and like, of course it was nonsense, but of course, like, Indian Country Today has an article about it from 2014, and they don't try to like disprove it. It's wild. I don't know what ICT is anyways. Like, is that even real journalism?
Debatable. It's like UNC's most wanted. No, but I learned from Z a couple days ago that apparently there's like a domesticated sheep that, like, there's still like a couple of a handful of flocks in the homelands that are like domestically raised, but they're like ancestral North American descended that have been like were domesticated at some point and now are like raised by white women with crystals for yarn.
What the? Are you, wait, what? Like sheep, like bighorn sheep?
I don't know.
Who told you this?
Apparently they, I have not looked into it. Do you want me to?
No, it's fine. Well, this will be, I think we're just have to have you on a second time, and we can just talk about myths and legends of native people from Southeast to Great Plains. I don't know.
I can only do the very small sphere that I know.
Fair enough. Well, I will call you when I'm done with recording this podcast. I hope you guys caught that, because that was a wild conversation. We're just going to move on from that. Blue-eyed people, but I don't know. That's wild. More questions than answers with that. I thought it was just me. Simple, shut, open, shut case. Have her on for like 30 seconds as she called on her way from work to be like, hey, no, I've never heard of them. Wasn't expecting blue eyes. Domesticated sheep, white women with crystals. That went somewhere I didn't expect. So anyways, we're back to part two, and we have swapped Altoids Wintergreen Mints for Nicorette because, you know, gotta stay off the smoking. Moving back to the Great Plains. And welcome back, everybody. So part of this email, they talk about the Mandan tribe of North and South Dakota told early French explorers that there were natives in the region with fair skin, red or blonde hair, and blue or gray eyes. As coming from a group of people that are within the Mandan sphere of influence, there is no such thing. So, like, also to keep in mind, right, even in the 1500s, these tribal nations across the continent are not isolated communities that don't know what's beyond the next hill, right? We know and have seen from the Hopewellian sphere of influence, the Puebloan sphere of influences, what's going on in the Northwest coast, that there are long-lasting and complex trade networks that have existed in the Americas for over 2,000 years, you know, a long time, and that there's trade system and networks and people are moving ideas and people and goods across the continent for a very long time. So the idea that only one or two tribes have heard of these people and the rest haven't is really hard to believe, right? Like, it could be myth or folklore. And that's one of those things, right? Like, we can look at fairy tales in Europe and we might be able to deconstruct some of the description of them. And we don't think of like native people from North America or people from Asia, right? We understand the context in which those fairy tales exist. But when we look at these contexts of North America and the, like, there might be these myths, legends, or fairy tales that talk about, you know, fair-skinned people, a lot of times that immediately gets misinterpreted or misused to suppose that there are like pre-European colonizers ahead of Columbus, right? And part of that can easily be to asserting different ethnic claims to like first peopling or first colonizers of North America, right? Like when we saw with the Kensington Runestone and the Oklahoma ones, and like, yes, thank you to Sadhu, Matt, for telling me I mispronounced that Oklahoma town wrong. I understand. I apologize. That is a Scandinavian immigrant tie-in to say, oh, well, we're one of the first people here, right? Like, and to try to have this sense of claim to a current area. I can imagine with some of these stories of fair-skinned people, red-haired people, immediately Gaelic or Irish gets brought in and that gets glommed onto by descendants of Irish immigrants. And it's not to say that, like, when it comes to these myths and fairy tales, Great Plains context or elsewise, like, we understand what colors are, right? Like, we know we saw what snow was, barn owls, like, we understand white, and we can understand diversity in people. You can look at the complexion of indigenous people of North America, and everyone's not the same shade of brown, right? There's different shades. Some people are more fair than others. Some folks are darker. And so when they say fair complexion, they might not be meaning white. They might just be saying, like, more like Inuit. I don't know. Versus, yeah, like I said, just like true, like European pale white, like never got out of the glens of Scotland. Just things to keep in mind, like those cultural contexts and cultural relativism. Maybe like, and also like albinism is also a thing. I don't think I've ever seen an albino native, but like if some of these stories of like an individual with like paler skin and red eyes, like that could be albino, right? And so we can see some of these things. And even going to the Paiute have these stories of, it's coming from the same email, right? Long-haired giants known as the Sitka, red-haired giants that is supposedly the Paiute knocked out. Now, once again, there are other tribes in the Paiute sphere of influence. What do they have to say, right? History's Mysteries has an article about these guys, and they talk about the Paiute knocking them out. That there was a war between the Paiute and the Sitka, and they're trapped in a cave and they were killed. I don't know what describes the giants. Who can say? It is possible that that might be referring to an actual event. Now, were they giants in the way that we think of giants, like George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire or Jack and the Giant Beanstalk, right? It's easy when we hear these stories, and I think we describe this when we talk about oral traditions of people in the Americas, to take our modern context, our modern wealth of knowledge from pole to pole, coast to coast, and overlay those onto stories of the past and try to make these dots. If we step back into 1600s, 1700s Paiutes, and they're telling us this story, what is it that's available to them, right? And how much of maybe a true story was over embellished to make the Paiute seem grander? Like maybe there was a group of people that the Paiute and the Sitka went at each other. The Sitka weren't giants, but like, you know, they're found in a cave and died. Like that could be them, right? With things as fantastical as this, like it, we really do have to look at these stories with a critical historical lens and deconstruct these narratives from such a lens and look at the availability of evidence and the preponderance of evidence. And we talk about today, there's over 575 federally recognized tribal nations, and many belong to like certain areas. So if the Mandan have this myth of like a white folk tribe that lives in the Missouri River, Poncas, Omahas, Pawnees, Arikaras, Hidatsas, and our neighbors are also going to have those stories and know of them because they don't exist in a vacuum, because there are like, especially living on the plains, as we talked about in the early episodes, in order to live on the plains, you can't just farm, you have to hunt bison. Like there can't be an isolated community that's just hanging out 365 and hiding away from everybody else like a bunch of leprechauns. They would not survive. Same in the Southeast, like that context of these like deer milkers that are making cheese, like they have to get out and around. Like those communities have to be refreshed. They have to have their like own seasonal rounds or settlement pattern, which they would have interacted with other people beyond the Muscogee. Right. We would see evidence of this in the archaeological record. Like that'd be pretty prominent to have a large settlement that looks nothing like everything else. You know, it'd be, you know, I guess a similar thing would be looking at like Moorish influence in the Spanish record, right? Like that's so different. Or looking at when Romans first show up into regions beyond the Italian peninsula, especially into like Britain, right? Or Germany. That is such a different archaeological signature that is so telltale. Like, why don't we see that in any of these places? Like, if there's giants in the Great Basin, what are they eating and what are they making and how is it, you know, fitting to whatever, like, their size? What kind of town do these red-haired folks in the Missouri River region have? Right. They don't just show up, like I said, in the first half of the segment and just start building earth lodges and they look just like everybody else. Right. There would be signatures that we can see. Like when the Spanish are moving around the Southeast, we can track that because they're always dropping stuff. Things break and they drop things. They lose things. And we can track DeSoto's expeditions. We can track Cortez moving around. We can track what's his Pizarro in South America. Like it's not just, you know, if Cortez had died and lost and for years and people went to go find him, they'd find his stuff strewn about, right? So, and especially how do you know if you have like these ancestral Irish getting to North Dakota, how'd they get there, right? Probably the Missouri. They would have had to go up the Mississippi. People would have noticed. And that's the hard part. There's lots and lots of people that used to exist here. And they're all trading and talking to each other, right? Especially if you have neighbors that are these odd white folks that are somehow like holding deer and raising them and making deer cheese, which is something that most of these people have never seen before. You're going to talk about it at the next like town hall or the next get together with the neighbors down the street. So I appreciate the email who sent this. This sent me down a really fun rabbit hole. I'm going to have the director of TDAR, the Digital Archaeological Repository. He's going to come and give us a chat. Nikki Klarman's still scheduled to chat at some point, and I'm still waiting to hear back, but I believe the TIPO for the Crow Nation will be on at some point too. So with that, I will let you guys go. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Send me emails. Send me topics. Love it. It's always a fun time. I'll chat with you guys later. See you next time. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarcpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.